We're talking with Dr. Brett Carver, our state wheat breeder at Oklahoma State University's Division of Agriculture. Brett, you're able to show off several of your newer varieties at these various wheat plot tours around the state. One you've got here at in Kay County is Bentley, and it does look pretty good.
Well, we can't be too surprised. I mean, it took us 7 years to decide, Ron, that we ought to let this one go and let other farmers take advantage of the characteristics it does have. And that I guess there are two big characteristics that we have seen over the years now and in the past 7 years is drought and freeze. And under those conditions, freeze being in the spring, those late freezes after the time when you think you're done with freeze, it has really shown some resilience under those conditions. It has a fairly good disease package. I mean, the stripe rust resistance on it is, I would say, intermediate to good. Just depends on how much inoculum is out there. Right. We were concerned also about leaf rust before this year, and we knew that leaf rust would be a possible weakness, but we didn't have a lot of data. This year we got plenty of data on leaf rust, mm-hmm. and we know leaf rust resistance is not going to be a strength of Bentley. Right. Otherwise, a lot of good characteristics.
Let's talk about that other new variety, not here. I know you're going to have it in Lahoma, Stardust.
Yeah, I like the name, I like the song, I like the variety, and I think those who want to try white wheat will like what they see. This is going to be everything that you expect in a hardwood winter, and I think more hopefully in terms of price. We'll see how that works out. There's no question there's a demand for hard white wheat. Sometimes we just don't see it in Oklahoma, but there is demand out there across the world. We are starting to see it in Oklahoma to some extent because of the movement towards whole grain foods in our diet, and white wheat just tends to fit the whole grain product a little bit better than hard red winter,
right,
or hard red in general. So it's that pull now that we're seeing domestically that's going to help eventually feed that demand in our foreign markets. It takes a variety like Stardust where we can get out of the panhandle. It can grow in the panhandle, but where we can get out and grow it on more acres and grow it hopefully near some of the mills that are located downstate.
Right. And I guess what this is a step toward that sprout tolerance, or in other words, keeping it from sprouting early. But you were kind of alluding to the folks here today that more work's going to be done on that particular issue.
No doubt. It's front and center when it comes to white wheat and getting white wheat to work in downstate Oklahoma. It's not a real tricky trait to work out. I mean, we already have sprout tolerance that's commensurate with the middle pack of the reds. You know, maybe not as tolerant as some of the most resistant reds, like the old Plainsman 5 variety. I'll never forget it. Couldn't get it to sprout. No way. It's nothing like that, but it's somewhere like in between Gallagher and Iva. Gallagher is weak on sprouting, Iva's strong. So right in the middle of that, you see Stardust. The lesson there is, you know, with a white wheat, you know, there is a window where you can tolerate high moisture conditions, even rainfall, but it can't tolerate it until early July, you know, just like a lot of red wheats. So it has to get out of the field.
You, as you showed off some of the experimentals today, one that really caught my attention was this combination of red and white. That's interesting that you've kept it around.
Yeah, it didn't make the trash can like so many would make when they, what we call, are segregating. They're segregating for different reactions to something, and in this case, a different kernel color. We have too many reds and too many whites in the program. We just go with the more pure stuff. Well, this one was just so good in terms of its yielding ability. Across Oklahoma, not just in downstate, but across Oklahoma, that we held on to it. And at the same time now, we actually do have head row projects at Stillwater, and that we'll look at for red and white and choose the best ones and then go back next year with a 12716R and a 12716W.
Let's talk. One thing that kind of jumped out at me as you've talked about the varieties down through the years, your experimentals especially, the fact that the variety of parentage and the fact that in a lot of cases you've got other public breeding programs, you've got some private companies that you can access to. It seems like we continue to have a pretty good working relationship within private and public sectors.
Overall, certainly within the wheat community, I think the spirit of cooperation is still there. I don't think it's there to the point we had it or the ease of cooperation we had maybe 5 or 6 years ago. But with a little bit more work, with a little bit more paperwork sometimes, you work things out on paper with agreements, you can still cooperate. And that's so important because cooperation means exchange of germplasm. And this is what guarantees wheat's future, is the ability to mix the germplasm up. Anytime we go, single truck genetic pipeline, we're exposing ourselves to as many as 14 diseases. That's a game we should not get into.
As far as future of wheat breeding, that public-private issue again, in other words, we've got more companies that are starting to step up and put more and more dollars into this. Right. For some talk about, maybe a GM crop of wheat at some point. Where are we going with wheat breeding, you think?
Going in a lot of different directions, to tell you the truth. GM is still one of those directions. We don't have that commercial public approval. Maybe it will happen in my career. I'm not necessarily counting on that. So we are looking at some other options. And one that everybody hears about and reads about probably is what we call CRISPR or CRISPR. It's basically gene editing. And it's basically using some of the tools of GM technology, but in a very temporary way. There's no foreign DNA that ends up in the plant. You're just modifying in a very accelerated way, beyond what would happen naturally, an accelerated way in the plant, and getting a new trait that you wouldn't, or you could come up with conceivably in nature. But this is a much more targeted, much more direct, and quicker way of getting at the final result. And I've talked about double haploids a lot, and double haploids are now very common in the vernacular wheat varieties across the plains, and it's going to become even more popular. That, I think, is going to have monumental effects. We haven't really seen it yet, but I think over time we're going to see yield progress accelerate because of double haploids.
They're going to be both private and public breeding programs. Obviously, you've got you're fairly well funded because of the monies that come back from OGI, and that, I'm sure that helps.
Thank you very much for mentioning that, because I need to mention, yes, we do get funding from the wheat producer through the licensing of seed, through the checkoff, also through the wheat genetics chair at Oklahoma State University. That was a grower funded in part, also by Miller and Baker, endowment that we utilize to fund the total program. And that total program does incur cost associated with producing double haploids, because we have made the decision we're not going to produce double haploids on campus. I think we can, it would be more cost effective to go off campus and arrange that through some service agreement. And we worked with the Kansas Wheat Innovation Center, and they've been very enjoyable to work with. And the quality of the product we're getting out of that center in double haploids is stellar. I can't be any happier with it.